Good morning. I'm Marianne Combs. Do you ever watch TV on your phone? If I'd asked that question 20 years ago, I would have gotten a blank stare. But increasingly, people are watching their favorite shows online as opposed to via cable or satellite. That means they can pick up the latest episode on their laptop, their tablet, or their phone and watch at their convenience, often commercial-free. But different shows live on different platforms, whether it's Netflix, Hulu, HBO, or an app for a specific TV station. And distribution deals complicate where they can be seen. This hour, we're joined by two television critics. Neil Justin writes for the Minneapolis Star Tribune. Welcome back, Neil. Good to have you here.
Good to be here.
And Dan Feinberg writes the column The Fine Print for The Hollywood Reporter. Welcome, Dan. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And, of course, we'd love to hear from you. Where are you watching your television? What platforms are you subscribing to? And if you could change something about the way you get your television, what would that be? You can give us a call at 651-227-6000. That's 651-227-6000 or toll free at 1-800-242-2828. Dan Feinberg, how do you watch television these days?
I am really old-fashioned, and I have to admit that I would say probably 85 to 90% of the TV I watch is either screeners because of what we do for a living or just on TV, really.
Live as it's coming to you. You're not streaming something to your screen.
Well, I watch it on my DVR, so I sometimes start an episode 15 minutes later, watch it the next day so that I can avoid commercials that way as well. But still in all, it is on my TV, in my living room, across from me on my couch. It's way too traditional, I would say.
Neil, how about you?
I wish I was doing that. I think I was the last critic on the planet Earth that was still requesting video VHS tapes. I was very sentimentally tied to that format. Last week? No. I think I was the last one getting DVDs. I mean, I really thought DVDs were just a fad. I will say in the last year, I'm watching more and more shows on my phone.
Really?
That's the easiest way, as Dan and I get video from the networks ahead of time. We usually get stuff a couple weeks ahead of time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just easier for me to look on my phone. It's not as enjoyable. And I'm probably not doing the shows as much justice as I do when I watched it on my regular screen. But to be honest, that's how I'm watching more and more television.
Hmm. Dan, what do you think has been the most significant change to TV viewing in recent years?
Well, I think that Neil just mentioned something very important, that we as critics are not necessarily giving these shows the most fair of shots. And it's kind of comical that something like The Terror on AMC, which premiered a couple weeks ago, it's this incredibly huge, elaborate production where it's all about the dark spaces and this amazing Arctic set that they built. And if we're watching it on a phone or on a computer, there's millions of dollars that went into production value that we're somehow just not appreciating. And I think that that's one of the most interesting things in terms of how anybody is watching TV anymore, is that producers and networks are putting so much money into making things look better and putting more special effects into things and anything they can do to differentiate one show from the next in the pile. And then people are watching the shows on their phones, in the subway, getting jostled around with subpar sound systems, et cetera. And there's this conflict between people watching TV in suboptimal ways and the fact that the people who are making the TV are trying perhaps harder than ever before to make their TV good and to stand out in a medium that it isn't being watched anymore.
But might they, you know, the next time they decide to stream that show, they might be watching it on their huge flat screen TV at home. And so they might want the full cinematic effect once they've watched it on the subway.
I think that would be ideal. I think that it would be great if people said, okay, maybe I didn't get everything I could have gotten out of this show on my phone. Next time I really will watch it on my TV. And I think that that's obviously what networks would dream of, is that people would go, okay, so I watched this off of Hulu or off of Amazon or off of whatever, but I know it would look even better on my TV, and it would look even better if I watched it live, and it would be even cooler if I also paid very close attention to the commercials.
But I
think that ship has probably sailed.
Yeah.
And it can go the opposite direction, too. Several years ago, Dan and I were at a screening in Los Angeles for a new show called American Horror Story. And I remember watching it on a big screen. We were at the studio lot, and it was like going to the movies. And I can't speak for Dan, but I think a lot of us walked out going, this is the greatest thing I've seen since Gone with the Wind. Well, and it was a very good series, particularly the first season. But you watch it on regular screen, and it's just not as phenomenal with the sound blaring at you in the big theatrical production. It didn't hurt that we were sitting next to Connie Britton while we were watching it. That, I recommend that highly if you can sit next to stars while you watch their work. But scale does matter, and it doesn't matter for everything. I think there are some things that are just as entertaining watching on your cell phone or watching on your screen during your coffee break at work. But there are a lot of shows, particularly the ones that the streaming services are getting into, that scale matters.
Yeah. And you mentioned the streaming services. It's been interesting to watch platforms for viewing television becoming the producers of television, whether it's Netflix or Hulu originals. Do you think it's paying off for them?
Oh, well, that is the I was going to say the $1 million question, but it's the $1 billion
right.
question. I mean, I'm interested in Dan's viewpoint because he's much wiser on these things than I am. But I keep waiting for the kingdom of Netflix to be exposed. I mean, I don't know how they're spending as much money as they are. They're outspending everyone, and they're getting terrific programming out of it, terrific stars. I can't for the life of me figure out what the economic plan is here. And that is the big question. These streaming services like Amazon, Hulu, and particularly Netflix are writing very, very big checks, and it's fantastic for the consumer. This is, we've used that term golden age time and time again, but if you're a consumer right now, it really is a golden age, and for fairly affordable prices. I don't know how long that can last.
Dan, what about you?
Yeah, I think the answer is that studios producing their own content for these streaming services, it has to be the way that they make money. There's no alternative, because otherwise they can't stay afloat. There is no way that an Amazon can pour apparently a reported $1 billion into their upcoming J.R.R. Tolkien, somewhat Lord of the Rings, somewhat Hobbit, somewhat Silmarillion, whatever TV series that they're planning with a 5-season order. Where does the money come from? And it is this remarkable thing where either they're going to start figuring out how to monetize it in ways that are really lucrative, or else one of these companies, and we haven't seen it yet, is going to have the most amazing of public falls, in which suddenly someone is going to admit, okay, we've been pouring billions and billions of dollars into programming that we've said that we could monetize through these 5 ways, and we maybe just couldn't. But I don't know who's going to have to admit that, and I don't know why they're going to have to admit it, what the big fallout is going to be. But no, the amount of programming that Netflix puts out, and this is on a weekly basis, is astounding. The amount of my life these days that is dedicated to watching Netflix screeners is a full-time job, and then I still have to watch everything else on TV. But being a Netflix TV critic exclusively could be a job.
And the sign that Netflix is getting so big is now they're starting to produce crap.
Yeah.
I mean, there was a time when Netflix seemed to be in the market for doing, at least trying to do, superior programming. Now they're more than willing to do mediocre and sort of less than middle-of-the-road programming. That just shows how big they are.
Yeah. But still, you don't think that with millions of people subscribing and paying $10 a month or whatever they're paying for both, because it's a different subscription for videos versus a subscription for the DVDs, I mean, for live streaming versus the DVDs, you don't think that that's enough money to cover the cost of what they're putting into their programming right now?
Well, not if it's $6 billion a year, and no one ever says, okay, we spent $6 billion this year. Next year, let's do $2 billion, you know, whatever. Let's go more intimate next year. No one does that. So it becomes an arms race, and apparently Netflix is prepared to spend $6 billion, and this continues to be with a B a year on original programming at $20 per subscription. It's hard to make that money back just on a standard subscription base. So as Neil says, Netflix, at one point, there was a specific thing that we thought that Netflix programming meant. And I think that more and more and more, it's becoming clear that what Netflix wants its programming to mean is not something, but everything. That they want it to simply be that there is not just something for everybody, but there is enough to fill your life for everybody. And it's an amazing business practice to have your goal be ubiquity, basically.
Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, you asked about the economics, and I'm not a shill for Netflix. As I just said, they produce a lot of crap. But from my endpoint, from an economic standpoint, Netflix is pretty cheap. I mean, especially compared to the kind of cable prices that people still have to pay because there's not carte blanche programming. So your cable bills, you know, for a lot of people, is $150 a month, if not more. You can get pretty much what you want from Netflix for $7 a month. And as Dan said, you know, they're doing everything now. And, you know, we talked before about somebody finally saying we can't keep up. We're gonna fall out. And I do think Netflix and Amazon and Hulu to a certain extent are hoping for that. But it's not so much that they're hoping that their streaming services fall out of the race. It's the networks that they hope will fall out of the race. And that's why you see Netflix imitating the network model more and more, because I think they truly believe or are gambling their future on the fact that one of the big four, ABC, NBC, CBS, one of them is going to say, we can't keep up. Mm. And they're going to drop out. And that money, those opportunities come their way.
Mm. We're talking this hour about television, how the way we watch television has changed over the years, and how we have so many different platforms to view it, the ways we watch our TV, and how that might be changing in the future as we move forward. We'd love to hear from you. How are you watching your TV these days? What's your favorite way of streaming? What apps are you using? Where do you think we're headed? How would you like to change things? What are the biggest annoyances for you, nuisances for you, when you're looking at streaming television, your favorite shows? Give us a call at 651-227-6000. That's 651-227-6000. Or toll free at 1-800-242-2828. That's 1-800-242-2828. So, Neil, do you see a time when we're streaming all of our television?
No, but I'm getting up there in age. So because I can't see doesn't mean it's not going to happen. Things are progressing more rapidly than I thought they would. There is still an appeal to live TV and the network model that I thought would keep them in business for a while. But if these streaming services get into live programming, and it seems like they may be heading in that direction, then all bets are off. You know, there's also the question of how long and how can network television, traditional television, stay interested and stay interesting. I just watched Jesus Christ Superstar on NBC, and I thought it was terrific. It's as good as anything being offered on cable or streaming services.
Mm-hmm.
That wasn't cheap. I don't know the numbers off the top of my head. I think it did pretty well, but those are few and far between. So, I'm seeing a day when the networks are less and less important, especially if news is not as big a part of their model. But I don't think it's going to happen next week. I don't think it's going to happen in the next 5 years, but it might be coming.
Dan?
I think it's definitely generational. Every once in a while, Neil and I will get invited to random colleges and universities to talk and all of that. And it's so inevitable that when you get in front of a room of people who are 18 to 21 and you say, how many of you actually own a TV, the number of people who so much as own a TV, much less watch all their TV on a TV, it's shrunk in mm-hmm. the past like 2 years
mm-hmm.
from
mm-hmm.
nearly everybody has one in their dorm room to, oh, I barely watch TV on TV at all. It becomes a thing where you're standing in line at Starbucks and people refer to the new program they discovered on Netflix, and it's something that really and truly aired on the CW or on Fox 2 years ago, but they refer to it as Netflix's iZombie. They have no awareness that it existed on an actual television network anymore. And so I think, honestly, it really is becoming generational. And I don't know that I think that in 5 or 10 years, TVs are going to be extinct. But yeah, less and less, and it may be more and more dinosaurs who are just watching their TV on their TV. People who insist, oh, I need to watch the Masters on my TV because it's pretty and green and it looks better in a 50-inch screen. But fewer and fewer people every year.
And this goes back to what you were talking about before about the importance of producing your own stuff, because your platform matters less and less. As Dan, a perfect example, I've got a big piece on New Girl coming out on Tuesdays. It prepares to go into its final 8 episodes. And over Easter, over Easter weekend, talking to a couple teenagers who have just discovered New Girl, and they're almost caught up. And as Dan said, I don't think they associate that with the Fox network at all. They caught it on Netflix, and talking to cast members recently, they said, you know, that show went from kind of a breakout hit its first year to kind of a dwindling hit. I mean, I think in its last few years on Fox, it was averaging less than 3 million people an episode. But once it got dumped on Netflix, it generated a whole new audience. It gave that show second life, and probably stayed on traditional television a couple seasons longer than it would have without that bump.
Huh.
And that's a bump everybody wants, right? Those younger people that Dan was talking about.
Yeah.
And it's also a bump that's completely invisible to us in the media, which
that's
is
right.
an interesting thing, because the ratings don't necessarily get impacted. So you look at something like Riverdale on the CW. If all you have at your disposal to give information on how many people watch that show is the live ratings, the live plus 3 day, the live plus 7 days, basically traditional metrics, it looks like nobody watches that show at all. And you would never know that apparently, and again, we don't have the information to defend it, Riverdale is huge internationally. It's huge on Netflix. This is what we're told. We have to believe it because it keeps getting renewed, even though the numbers say, why would you ever do that? But the answer is, because all of these invisible numbers point to it actually being a fairly massive success, we just don't have any way of seeing what that looks like because it's all imaginary and Netflixy.
And just to, you know, add on to that, you know, it's forcing, and in a good way, it's forcing Dan and I to do some shoe reporting and not just rely on the numbers anymore, because we have to rely on what the buzz is out there rather than what we see in the Nielsen ratings. A perfect example of that is Korean soap operas.
Really?
Nobody pitches us those stories. Nobody talks about it. Nobody really knows the numbers. But when I go to high schools and colleges and I ask kids what they're watching, inevitably that comes up. And it used to be just in the Asian American community. Now it's all over the map. I can't go to a school and somebody doesn't say, that's what I watch primarily. Maybe Dan's been watching Korean soap operas since he was a child, but I don't know anything about this world. And I was just thinking to myself last week, I got to dig in and do a story on this, because there's a whole world of niche programming and niche interests that are out there that old fuddy-duddies like Dan and I are not on our radar. And that's exciting.
Yeah,
that's exciting. There's a world out there that we're discovering in not the traditional ways.
You know, I would think that 10 years ago, or you know, it would still be hard to know what to pick to cover because there's so much going on. There's so much TV out there. But in this day and age, when you have so much content being produced all the time, how do you even know? Other than going out to high schools and asking the kids what they're watching. But I mean, I would think that the choosing what to cover as a TV critic must be a bit overwhelming, because you want to reach audiences where they're interested, but there's so much to look at, and you can't. And because you can't tell by the ratings now, you don't know what is really popular with people or what could be a sleeper hit.
I just called Dan.
It's completely guesswork. It really is. And twice a year, Neil and I, we have the Television Critics Association press tour, which is in Los Angeles. And that's a 14 to 18 day gulag marathon of networks and streaming services bringing their new programming to the nation's TV critics, all assembled in a room doing marathon press conferences one after another, introducing new shows with all of their talent there talking about it. And it really is almost an indispensable way of getting a showcase for what's interesting, what people want to promote, what people can sell and make sound intriguing. And I find it just helps so much. But the real answer, more than anything, is things are inevitably falling through the cracks in ways that they didn't before. And also, I think that there's some awareness of things falling through the cracks. So if you look at Netflix's motto, they have the huge shows that they promote everywhere and that you could not avoid knowing are coming out. But almost every week they have something smaller that just sort of slips onto the service. And in an ideal world, those are the things that people discover, where Netflix doesn't spend a lot on production. They spend very little on promotion. And then suddenly, 2 weeks later, it's the thing that everybody's talking about, perhaps even more than the big thing that was supposed to have come out that week. It's kind of the Stranger Things syndrome, where Stranger Things, when it first premiered, was almost an afterthought. It was, oh, here's this little 80s pastiche Winona Ryder exclamation point, but you've never heard of anyone else. And then it actually had this long tail where people were talking about it for 6 months, as opposed to the frequent motto, which is, okay, here's a new show. Everybody's going to binge it in 1 week. And by 1 week later, everyone will have forgotten it existed. So Netflix needs both of those things, the immediate huge big hits that are there immediately and gone, but also the long tail things. Something like On the Block from a couple weeks ago is the kind of show which got very little promotion when it came out, and I still see people actually talking about it. And Netflix needs those things as much as they need the huge things.
Mm-hmm. I have to say, you know, binge watching is a term that didn't exist until Netflix released an entire season of House of Cards all at once. Here's Kevin Spacey about that moment.
The audience wants the control. They want the freedom. If they want to binge, as they've been doing on House of Cards and lots of other shows, then we should let them binge. I mean, I can't tell you how many people have stopped me on the street and said, thanks, you sucked 3 days out of my life.
And this is something that happens with increasing frequency. People talk about it all the time. Oh, I just binge watched such and such show. And I believe now the technical definition of binge watching is 6 episodes or more of something in one run, which just makes my eyes hurt thinking about it. But how has this immediate gratification changed the way we watch TV? Is this a good thing? Is there a downside to binge watching?
I think there's a good side and a bad side. I think with certain programs, binge watching is heavenly, especially with sitcoms, where you've got, again, the network model is 22 minutes, and I just binge watch a bunch of Will and Grace because I hadn't caught up with the season, and that was a lot of fun, and it just breezed by, and it just seemed natural. A show like Black Mirror, for example, people talk about binge watching that. Even watching 4 or 5 episodes, I fear for their mental health that they're watching a pretty dark and challenging show in a row. And the pleasure, and this is the downside. I mean, I think there are more good than bad. But I think the downside is watching that episode once a week in the traditional model, sort of letting it sink in, talking about it with your friends, because we all used to watch TV at the same time, right? Mm-hmm. And you came in Monday or the next day and gossiped about it and tried to figure out, you know, the classic example is who shot JR. Mm-hmm. You know, now you wouldn't wait a whole summer to find out who shot JR. You'd wait 5 minutes, you'd go to the bathroom, and then you'd find out who shot JR in the next episode. I was thinking this week as a kid, because Stephen Boschko passed away, and Hill Street Blues, as a teenager, watching Hill Street Blues every week was really my first introduction to sort of that suspense of Thursday night that show would end, a lot of them with cliffhangers, and I would spend the rest of the week in agony anticipating what was going to happen and guessing what was going to happen. And
is that a good use of your emotional space and energy?
Well, it was much better than the other options I had in high school, believe me. This kept me out of great, great trouble. I think it's fun. I mean, from a pop culture standpoint and from a conversational standpoint. But again, that was human interaction, yeah. And so it opens up a mirror to psychological questions. But I do think there was a fun aspect of waiting every week or even waiting a summer sometimes to figure out what was going to be happen that's gone. But maybe I'm just being a fuddy-duddy. And as I said, I think there's more good than bad. And I just fall in line with anything Kevin Spacey says.
Irony is thick in this room here. Hey, Dan, what about you? What do you think of binge watching?
Well, I think that it definitely reflects the way that the human instinct is to watch television. And I think that without any question, this is the way that, in the same way that if you put people at the front of a buffet, people aren't going to go through and get reasonable portions and go, okay, well, I have what I need. I'm no longer going to be hungry. I'm done. No, people are going to load their plate. They're going to go up 3 or 4 more times, and they're going to keep eating until they win the buffet. That's just the human instinct. And I think that binge viewing and the Netflix motto, which I was definitely skeptical of when House of Cards premiered. I thought, people won't watch this way. Why would people watch this way? Well, they do, and that's apparently absolutely instinctive and baked into our DNA. I do miss the idea of a conversation that is ongoing and elongated rather than a conversation which is everybody rushed to be on the same page by, I don't know, Saturday morning or Sunday morning about the show that premiered on Friday, and then we're on to the next thing the next week. Last year's big Emmy winner was Handmaid's Tale, and this was a big
That's a Hulu series, right?
Sure.
Yeah.
Exactly. And so it was the first streaming show to win the Outstanding Drama Series Emmy. And part of why, to me at least, Handmaid's Tale worked as well as it did is because Hulu has said, we're not going to do the Netflix thing of every week. We're going to drop everything and then move on to the next show. Handmaid's Tale came out every single week, episodically, normally. And I saw people online complaining about that, going, why can't I have three episodes now? But it meant that Handmaid's Tale kept having a conversation that kept going over 2 months in the way that, you know, a TV show traditionally does. And I think that that was a huge benefit rather than just having every episode of Handmaid's Tale come out in 1 week, everybody going, my God, this is the best show on TV. And then by the next week, moving on to the next show. Instead, it actually built an ongoing conversation. It became threaded into society and pop culture. You know, there was a Saturday Night Live parody and all of that, which is harder and harder to do because of the immediacy of everyone binging everything in the Netflix model. It actually had a chance to build. And I think that is a valuable thing that still can matter.
Okay.
And yet I do worry that people waited and watched Handmaid's Tale all in 1 weekend, which, and to catch up, which, you know, good for them. But I do worry, again, about their mental health. And about whether they're getting the full, you know, impact of that. I remember in college, for, again, various reasons, most of them involved delinquency, I read War and Peace in 3 days.
I worry about your mental health, too.
That's a stupid way to read War and Peace.
You know, we've got a full bank of callers who've been waiting patiently to get on, so let's go to Nancy in St. Paul. Nancy, thank you for your patience.
Hi. My family switched to Roku recently, about a year ago. So we can get Hulu, Netflix, HBO, Showtime when we want to watch something. We usually do that with Showtime. We watch Shameless, and then we get rid of Showtime. It's cut our bill, like, to about a third of what it was. But then we can also go back and binge watch shows that we've missed. Like, right now, my husband is working through all 16 seasons of CSI.
Whoa.
And, yeah, and our kids, you know, my son can watch on his Xbox. My daughter can watch on her laptop. We can watch on the TV since we're older. But not only has it, I think, given us better choices, but we can go back and watch the things that we've missed, too. And we're paying, like I said, a third of what we used to pay with cable.
Wow, great call, Nancy. Thanks for that. So is Roku the solution for people who are, have too many interests in too many different platforms? Dan?
Roku or Apple TV or several other things. I just transitioned from Roku to Apple TV for no particular good reason except general brand loyalty. But even then, I could have had an Apple TV 5 years ago and I didn't.
But with Apple TV, are you paying a flat monthly fee or are you paying per episode that you're watching?
No, it's the technology. It's the little square on the top of my box. And then I still have to pay the services that I want to subscribe to. In the same way, it's the same thing with Roku, is you still have to pay for a Netflix subscription, a whatever or whatever. It just puts everything all in the quote-unquote same place in the little hockey puck on the top of your TV.
Ah, okay. You're listening to Minnesota Public Radio News. I'm Marianne Combs, and we're talking this hour about how we watch television, how it's changed over the years, and where it's headed. My guests are TV critic Neil Justin with the Minneapolis Star Tribune and TV critic Dan Feinberg, who's a TV critic with The Hollywood Reporter. And we have a full bank of phones. Let's go to Mara in Fargo. Mara, welcome to the conversation. Mara, you there?
Yes.
Hi.
Hi. Say, first of all, I feel that all shows move so fast, and I'm not in a hurry. I just want to sit and enjoy the movie or the sitcom, whatever is on TV. And the other thing I wanted to share is I watched the Oscars this year, and to me, for someone my husband and I's age in our 60s, it was a wonderful performance. Everything was nice on the Oscars, a throwback to the past and everything. So we enjoyed that. But not having internet and living on a farm south of a big city, we don't have a lot offered to us. So we do subscribe to Netflix for DVDs and enjoy those. But we sometimes wonder, with the limited amount of shows are available or stations available to us, it seems like it's getting less and less, and that I find myself thinking, eventually, are we going to have to, we won't have any TV available to us unless we pay for it. So I was wondering what your thoughts are on that. And also, I think we should bring back the old-fashioned variety show. I think we're ready for that as a country.
All right, Mara, thanks for your call. Neil, what do you think? Is she ever going to be able to get good quality programming? Or is there going to be a time when her access to TV shows is just going to disappear because she's on a farm and has no internet?
Well, I think she's doing pretty well. I mean, she's got Netflix. And remember, cable came around originally to service people like her and her husband. You know, it was created for people in rural areas that weren't getting good, good reception from network television. And Netflix is opening up, you know, so many doors. Every time I think PBS, federal funding needs to stop and there's no reason for PBS to exist anymore, I'm reminded of people like her that may not have the bill to pay for cable or services that offer arts programming and documentaries. I think of, if you just have Netflix and you have PBS, the amount of documentaries that are available to you now is enormous. We don't talk about it enough because we're fascinated with the return to Jersey Shore, but this is a fantastic period for documentaries. So I think there's a lot for her to digest. And I do think every once in a while the networks step up and are still creating great programming. So I think you can be down on the farm and still get wonderful entertainment.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Mark on the line in Minneapolis. Mark, welcome to the show. So how are you watching TV these days?
Marianne, thank you so much for having me, and
sure.
And a very great conversation, timely. I have three daughters, and they happen to have five brothers. We started the journey about 3 years ago, where we were looking to cut cost, and it was about cost containment, and it became really a content driven story, and we ended up cutting the cord.
Which cord? The entire TV cord? Or
that's correct. Yeah.
Wow.
We cut the TV cord and went full Apple ecosystem, where we basically looked at anything we had was really just a monitor, right? And we started to look at content that was out there, like PBS, and a lot of free content that is there. I'm an executive for a medical company, and so, you know, the limitation for me was accessing a lot of news content. And, you know, there's great content out there that's free. And so we started to dive into this and really say, you know, why are we paying, $150 a month for some of the content? We actually did the Netflix thing, but we blew through a lot of their content because a lot of it was either aged at that point or just not the content that we wanted for our family.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can imagine with that many children, we've got all ages and you can't put House of Cards on there with a five-year-old, right? And we got tired of inviting Mike and Molly into our living room. And so, you know, World News is probably was the initial challenge because that wasn't initially streamed. But, so we actually got rid of even the TV itself. Now we're going to upgrade it, but because the new OLEDs are out there. But we actually are just looking at it like a monitor. I mean, all our kids are able to get on an iPad or a MacBook Air and get easily to, let's say, watching The Flash on CW to, pretty much any content. And to, I think it was Neil's point that or David's point around PBS, there's some great documentaries out there that are just fabulous as far as like, Frontline,
mm-hmm.
right? You can easily access that. So anyway,
right.
that's my comments around it. It was cost containment, and now it's been content containment around let's digest what we want, when we want it, And I don't think we have to spend $150 a month. The cable companies give you A, B, and C, where, you know, this is where Netflix and Hulu can really step in. So,
oh, great.
Thanks for your time.
Thanks for calling. Dan, what do you think of what Mark's saying? Does this seem to be, do you think he's part of a growing trend out here? Is he common?
Oh, he's very much part of a growing trend. I think that the thing about cord cutting is that you maybe do not have access to everything. And the question becomes, does it matter? And does it matter at all if you have access to already then still more stuff than you could ever watch given all of the available hours in your life? Does it matter that you're missing a bunch more hours that you wouldn't have time for anyway? And I think that that's the key. If you're not worried about getting absolutely everything and you're willing to accept the fact that some things you're not going to get first run and that maybe a couple you might have to wait a few months or a few years or whatever for, that's, I would say, ideal for many people, for most people. It's a great way of saving money. If you simply aren't worried about the fact that there might be a handful of things that you're missing in the immediate present, and you're willing to say, well, I'm getting so much other stuff, it's not like I'm ever bored. It's not like I ever have a lack of things to watch on TV. And I know that when Neil and I both started doing this, you used to have conversations with people at parties, and people would say things like, oh, I don't watch TV at all, or, oh, there's nothing on TV, and no one says that anymore, except for really, really sad people you don't want to talk to. But that's probably the biggest change, is that the people who say, oh, there's nothing good on TV, oh, it's only reality trash, they don't exist so much anymore, because it's pretty much undeniable that there's stuff for everyone.
Yeah. You know, I'll see these articles come out in the sort of clickbait news media saying these shows are leaving Netflix on April 1st. What's going on with that? Why is it that we see shows move away from the platforms, that they're there for a certain amount of time and then they go?
I think it generates excitement, right? I mean, if you know something, oh, I better go and watch that before it goes away. It'll be back. I mean, you know, these movies, the original Star Wars will be back in a few months if you wait, Netflix. I mean, I don't know. I don't know what you think, Dan. I think it's just marketing, right?
Yeah. Well,
no, I think it's also content deals and studio ownership, which, again, is part of the reason why Netflix wants to own Netflix content, because House of Cards is never going off of Netflix.
Right.
Whereas the package that they have with Warner Brothers TV or Sony TV could go off the air, and then it becomes the where on earth is my Friday Night Lights going? And for years, Friday Night Lights was available to stream on Netflix, and then it vanished. And, you know, once upon a time, and by once upon a time, I mean 5 years ago, people used to own DVD sets of things. But there were a few months where suddenly people couldn't watch Friday Night Lights, or they had to actually try to watch Friday Night Lights. And instead, yesterday, Hulu made a deal, Amazon made a deal where all of Friday Night Lights is going to be streaming on Amazon. And so you sometimes have to keep an eye on where the different studio packages are traveling at any given moment. And it's a little bit of a shell game, because the thing you watched on Netflix last week might turn out to be on Hulu the week after. And I'm sure that's frustrating for customers. But on the other hand, if you're Amazon and you didn't have Friday Night Lights last week and you have Friday Night Lights this week, that's a handful of new subscribers, because people just don't want to be without their Friday Night Lights.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Lona on the line from Richfield. Lona, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks for the conversation. Really good. I have two comments. The first one being, I agree, no one should watch more than two episodes of Black Mirror at one time. I'm a really tech-savvy, kind of futuristic kind of person, and I can't get through more than two without taking a breath, definitely. I actually sympathized a little bit with the caller from Fargo earlier. I think, you know, the cable companies and the broadcast companies, the networks, getting in bed with each other for a little bit too long is really what caused a lot of what's going on here right now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm still frustrated today when I go to try to watch something on a broadcast channel and they say, who is your service provider? And if it's not one of, because I don't have a service provider, a cable provider anymore, if I don't have that, then I can't watch the programming. And that's really frustrating, right? And it means that the broadcast people have decided not to help rural populations, even though, you know, the airwaves belong to the U.S. population.
Mm-hmm.
And secondarily, it means that the cable companies tried to own things for way too long, and they didn't get to the a la carte concept the way that we have now with all these streaming services. So I just moved from Richfield to Bloomington. I'm going to be moving there next month. And I had to call Comcast and get my internet service through a cable company. And I got to tell you, I was super disappointed.
Interesting. Okay. Lona, thanks for that. You know, Lona brings up a really key question to me, which is how powerful is the consumer? She mentioned that, you know, having to pay, go through these certain methods. I think about Game of Thrones and HBO and how so many people were clamoring. They wanted access to Game of Thrones. They didn't want HBO necessarily, but they really the demand for Game of Thrones was so strong. And now we have HBO Now, which is a phone app that you can get. You don't have to have a cable subscription, an HBO subscription directly. You can just get the app on your phone if you want to watch the show. So it seems like certain things are responding to consumer demand, but other ways these producer deals are resistant to doing what is good for the viewer. What do you think, Neil?
I think these companies, all media companies, are more beholden to the consumer than ever before. That's a good and bad thing. Again, probably more good than bad. I can speak in the newspaper world. You know, we used to do what's called focus groups.
Mm-hmm.
We would bring in people and give them pizza, and they would tell us what they were reading and what they were not reading. And I was suspected those were a little bit tainted because people wanted to impress whoever was running the focus group.
Mm-hmm.
So I never put much stock in that because nobody wants to say the main reason they get the newspaper is to read Beetle Bailey.
Right.
Just as nobody wants to say that they watch the Kardashians, right? Nobody in their right mind would say that to strangers.
Yeah.
Now, with the numbers in newspapers, and even if Netflix won't share the numbers, they know what people are actually watching. We know in the newspaper business, because of the digital world, what people are actually clicking on, not what they say.
And it's the obits and the sports scores.
And, well, but it, yeah, right. And important international news.
Right, uh-huh.
You know, it's just amazing to see. And the bad thing is you don't want to be totally dictated by the consumer because sometimes they need their vegetables.
Yeah.
And that's true in the media world, too. But as I recall, House of Cards came about, or at least Kevin Spacey's casting in it, was that Netflix looked at the numbers in their catalog and realized that Spacey movies did very, very well. Dan, you may correct me on that if I'm wrong, but I think they did look at what people were ordering on Netflix before agreeing to pay Spacey. And I'm sure that they looked at numbers of what did well before they paid big money for Full House, which mm-hmm. they tell us is a huge hit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's certainly the case with the gigantic pact that Netflix has with Adam Sandler, where one of those things where they really were able to look at their numbers and they were able to go, okay, our viewers really, really love Adam Sandler. And the amount of money that we could throw at Adam Sandler to make disposable, fairly awful movies every 4 months almost, that we can totally cover because we know that people will watch that. I think that without any question, consumers are controlling things more than ever before. I think that Netflix and Hulu and Amazon and the cable networks, they're all grasping to hold on to as much control as they possibly can, and they make little accommodations bit by bit. So, yes, you could only watch HBO on HBO for many years, and then HBO Go came along, and you could watch your HBO on HBO Go, and that was convenient, too. And HBO said, oh, if you need to share your passwords a little bit here and there, it's okay. Life goes on. But then HBO Now came along. So it's giving people these different ways of watching, and yet for all of the different accommodations that HBO makes, Game of Thrones is still the most pirated show on television by a vast, vast margin.
Really?
So obviously they're not accommodating everybody, but on the other hand, again, HBO is able to look at the numbers and say, okay, we made these three accommodations so that people could spend more money with us to watch these things still. And even if we're losing millions, hundreds of millions of dollars on people pirating the show, we're still making enough that maybe we've made enough accommodations. And it's all about when the bottom line starts getting eaten into, people start making accommodations. When the networks and the cable channels and the streaming services start getting hurt, that's when they try to wiggle around and make changes to make more money. That's just business.
Yeah, and I do think, you know, when we look back, the biggest con game in the history of media will be the fact that cable for decades was able to charge people really steep bills for 200 channels they'd ever watch.
57 channels and nothing's on.
Yeah, and I'm shocked that, and I think lobbyists have more to do with this than anything else, that the government didn't stop that a long time ago. I think the consumer now is going to stop that, and you've had a couple callers that have said, basically said just that.
Yeah. We've got time for one more call. Let's go to Ben in Owatonna. Ben, welcome to the program.
Hi. So there was a news article that was published on a file sharing news website called Torrent Freak. They had a quote from Mega Upload founder Kim.com where he basically asked the question, why don't all the Hollywood studios just get together, make one website that had every single copyrighted film you could think of, going back to Gertie the Dinosaur, every Humphrey Bogart movie, even movies made today. Why don't they do that? Because he figured if they just got all together, made one website, shared in the costs, it would be the biggest, most profitable website in the history of the internet.
Hmm. All right. Good question. Thanks, Ben. So, Dan, why don't we just put it all in one place so that people aren't as tempted to pirate? Because it's right there. It's available. They just need to subscribe to that.
Because you would have to find a way to get executives at 10 multi-billion dollar companies and their lawyers to go through and figure out who got what share of the pie, and everyone would want the bigger share. Basically, it comes down to how many 800-pound gorillas you can possibly have in a room. So from a consumer point of view, the simple answer is yes, of course. Putting every movie in Hollywood history streaming onto one site would be easily the most convenient thing for me. And at the end of the day, after all of the negotiations, after all of the conversations, after all of the deal-making, it probably would be incredibly profitable for any of the network studios, whatever, who became involved. But the process of doing it, I think it would make everybody's head hurt so much to even think about sitting down in that room and having those negotiations that I think it's a long way from happening.
It goes against their capitalist nature.
Yes, exactly.
Bigger chance that we have world peace.
True.
So we just got a couple minutes left here. I have to ask each of you, what's your favorite show to watch right now? Neil? What are you watching these days that you absolutely love and can't get enough of?
Oh, my goodness. Why do I always freeze when I – well, this is something I thought Jesus Christ Superstar was a lot of fun. And I was really taken with the Gary Shandling documentary. And this is interesting because it's on HBO, but it was 4.5 hours long. I don't think HBO would have necessarily done a 4.5 hour, but in the past – but
the Gary Shandling documentary?
Yeah. That's a lot. But I think they're thinking about it in the Netflix, Amazon model that people are going to watch it on the go. They're watching it in segments. They won't necessarily watch it at 8 p.m. on a Monday and Tuesday. And so they have the freedom to do that. And it's a terrific 4.5 hours.
Dan?
I am on my third viewership already of last night's episode of FX's Atlanta. This week's episode of Atlanta was so strange and unusual and unlike anything I have ever seen on television. And it's probably the fifth or sixth episode of this season that I could say that about. So this week, at least, if you ask me what the best thing is on TV that I'm watching, it's Atlanta. And this week's episode broke my brain, as we say on the internet.
Well, I'm super excited for season two of Westworld. I can't get enough of that show.
You're the one.
I'm the one. I'm just the one. Yes. No, I think it's a fabulous exploration of what it means to be human and really cool characters and plot narratives. Oh, yeah. All over the place. And a great score. So yeah, that would be my vote. So thank you so much to the two of you. This hour has flown by. And you guys made me laugh a lot, which I really appreciate. So Neil Justin, TV critic, Star Tribune, thank you so much for being here this hour.
Thank you.
And Dan Feinberg, television critic for The Hollywood Reporter, thank you so much for joining us this hour. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
All right. You're listening to NPR News. Thanks for listening.